dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Matt, I've had the privilege of knowing and working with in various phases of that war for a very long time, and who brings uncommon intelligence to its course and to its understanding as well as to its practice, is Douglas J. Feith. For 4 years, he was the number three man in the Department of Defense under George W. Bush, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. These days, he is a senior fellow and director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute. Among many other accomplishments, Doug Feith is the author of War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon, at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. He's a close friend, mentor to me, and I'm always delighted to have him as a guest. Doug Feith, welcome back. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you.
So let us begin with a very important piece that you wrote in the Wall Street Journal last week, Doug, entitled The War on Israel Never Ends. And I'd like to ask you to address that general proposition, but through the specific lens of the seeming involvement in that war against Israel by the Obama administration. What on earth is going on here?
Well, it's clear that the President Obama and John Kerry, our Secretary of State, have an idea in their heads that the reason there is not peace between Israel and the Palestinians is because of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And that was a main point of this UN resolution that the United States allowed to pass in the Security Council, even though we could have vetoed it. And it was a main theme of the speech that Secretary of State Kerry gave a day or two after that, or a few days after that UN action. And I mean, they really have a view that is contrary to history of what the problem is between Israel and the Arabs. And the I think a much more accurate understanding of the nature of the problem is that there has been an ideological objection by the Arabs to the existence of the State of Israel since even before Israel came into existence. And that's why when Israel came into existence, it had to fight a war. And then in 1967, when Israel acquired the territories on which there are now these settlements that that Mr. Obama and Mr. Kerry think are so important and are the reason for the conflict. There was the thing that's so peculiar about saying that they're the reason for the conflict is they are built on land that Israel captured in the 67 war. And the reason there was a war in 67 is because there was an Arab objection to Israel's existence before that.
Doug Feith, this is really an incredibly important point that our colleague Harold Rode mentioned to me the other day. And that is that you describe a sort of ideological view. It seems from what Harold said as though it's kind of embedded in Sharia that if there is land that has been occupied by Muslims, it will forever be Muslim. It can be no other. And they must do everything they can to return it to that status. So this does seem to make, you know, a mockery of the whole idea that there can be anything other than at best sort of ceasefires or hudnas with these characters. But Obama is relentlessly pressing. And what I'm interested in is, you see it, is has he changed the policy of the United States government materially with these actions at the UN and the Kerry speech? And do you see a continuity, or is there actually a wrecking operation perhaps?
Well, I think that what the Obama administration did by allowing this recent UN resolution to pass was a major departure from American policy for decades. To understand it, I've got to go back to the Carter administration. President Jimmy Carter was the first president to announce that he believed that the Israeli settlements in the territories captured by Israel in 67 are illegal under international law. So the Carter administration basically invented that argument for the United States. Very soon after they made that argument, Ronald Reagan became president and was asked, does he also think that the Israeli settlements are illegal? And he repudiated the Carter position. Now, there's a very big question that I think reasonable people can debate about. Is it sensible for Israel to have the settlements policy that it has? And, you know, should they be doing this or that and building the settlements here or there, restricting them in some ways or another? All of those are things that I think reasonable people can argue about. But the argument that the settlements are illegal is a really insidious argument, because it, for various reasons that we don't have to get into, but by legal analysis, if you argue that the settlements are illegal, you're actually calling into question the legal basis on which Israel itself came into existence. That's why it's really a profound question. So no president since Ronald Reagan has endorsed the Jimmy Carter position until now.
Right. And that is expressly what this UN resolution does, is establish as illegal and making it a matter of international law through this mechanism that Israel must, dismantle or otherwise, accommodate Palestinian demands with respect
to
this.
But I wouldn't say it establishes it, just to be clear. This recent resolution declares that the settlements are illegal. But that doesn't make them illegal. And in fact, I think the better legal analysis is that they are not illegal. This is a typical UN hot air operation. And the UN Security Council, as it has done many times in the past, has disgraced itself by saying something that's not true. And so they have declared the settlements to be illegal. It's not a legally binding judgment. The UN Security Council is not a court of law. And it doesn't have jurisdiction over this to declare them to be legal or illegal. But in any event, what they said is not based on a good, sound legal analysis.
Well, I get that. And needless to say, I'm very much in agreement with you on this. But Doug Feith, as a quite accomplished international lawyer, is it not the general thesis of certainly the admirers of the UN, the UN itself, many in the press, and certainly the Obama administration, that by virtue of the UN saying something is so, whether it's true or not, it is ipso facto true. It is now illegal. It is now international law that they are illegal. Am I missing something here?
No, I would put it a little differently. There is a political debate in the world about Israel, all aspects of Israel, including the settlements. In that political debate, when the UN Security Council makes what is essentially a political declaration, it has political implications. It doesn't establish that the settlements are illegal. It says, as a political matter, so now the UN Security Council's prestige, such as it is behind the political declaration that these settlements are illegal. And that's going to be used as a political tool against Israel by the forces that promote, boycott, divestiture, and sanctions against Israel. It's going to be used by Israel's enemies all around the world.
But not in the world court, not as a matter of international law.
Let's be clear. I mean, a lot of people talk about international law, as if it's a real thing like domestic law. It's not. And the Arab-Israeli conflict is not going to be determined by a law court. It's basically, a political and military battle. And in that battle, the UN Security Council has just lined up behind Israel's enemies on an important point of argumentation.
I know it's entirely speculative, but there's rumored to be in the offing at a Paris conference in mid-month, yet another turn of the screw before Obama leaves office, perhaps even some kind of recognition of a Palestinian state. Is that conceivable in your view?
Yeah, it's a possibility. I think that, what's so ironic is that Obama keeps pushing for a negotiated settlement, and yet the actions that he's taking basically make it almost impossible for the negotiations to succeed because he's deciding issues that should be negotiated in advance of the negotiations, and he's deciding them in favor of the Arabs.
Doug Feith, thank you so much for this extraordinarily important insight and analysis. Come back to us again often in 2017, my friend. Diana West joins us next. We'll talk about the antecedents of the UN, how it came to pass, and why it's really not surprising it's playing the very dubious role it is today. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by our friend and colleague Diana West, an extraordinary resource in the war of ideas, a woman who has long written a syndicated column, is now blogging at dianawest.net, the author of Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Always welcome, as she was throughout 2016 and years before, but most especially with the new year. Happy New Year to you, Diana. Glad to have you back.
Oh, happy New Year to you too, Frank.
We do have reason to believe it will be. Thank you very much for making it so here. Diana, you've written recently about a subject we were just discussing with Doug Feith about the UN and its role. Remind us of the history of how this organization came to be and who were prime movers in shaping it.
Well, the organization came to be as a result of World War II. The alliance that defeated Hitler went on to create this world body that was supposed to police the world and prevent war. There was just one major flaw, which was that at the helm of this project was a Soviet agent named Alger Hiss, who worked inside the United States State Department, organizing, gathering other agents around him, working to create a world body that was essentially a Soviet front.
A Soviet front, and one that by its structure lent itself to Soviet influence operations and, in fact, really the domination of the organization as a whole. Isn't that how it worked out?
Well, that's how it worked out. And it was that way from the very start, because also involved in the United Nations planning was a bevy of Soviet agents, later exposed, Lawrence Duggan at the State Department, Noel Field, who was a close friend of Duggan, Henry Julian Wadley. You also had David Weintraub, another later exposed agent. You also had a man named John Carter Vincent, who was very big in Chinese relations, who would later be identified in Senate hearings as the principal fulcrum for this front known as the Institute for Pacific Relations inside the State Department that was used by communists to orientate American Far Eastern policies to communist objectives.
Diana West, you've laid out a picture of a rigged game that is indeed still playing out as a virulently anti-American, anti-Israel, really anti-freedom operation. I guess we shouldn't be surprised given sort of its birth and its genetic code. But as you look at what's happening at the moment in the United Nations, with now the active help and support of President Obama, John Kerry, Samantha Power, and the like, we seem to be getting more buy-in by the United States government in this pretty much anti-freedom agenda. Is that how you see it?
Well, it is. And I think it can't be emphasized enough that in the founding of this essentially global government were people who were trying to further the goals of global government, who were interested in global communism as an organizing structure for the world. And this, of course, has never changed. This has always been the objectives of people who have been pushing for these United Nations type programs. At the same time the UN was formed, we also saw the whole global monetary system take shape, again, under another later exposed Soviet agent from the United States. That would be Harry Dexter White, who was the original chief at the International Monetary Fund. So when we look at these systems and look at how they function today, we can't be surprised at how they are all increasing, thickening, tightening these networks of global governance that are antithetical to any sort of democratic republic functioning as a nation state. And this kind of sets up the whole paradigm that we're witnessing here with Donald Trump, who comes in and becomes president, speaking specifically about breaking with these types of global fora and returning to an America First policy that depends on a strong nation state that is not under the thumb of these global organizations, treaties, and so on.
And elites, yeah. And that exhibits and practices, exercises sovereignty, which is, of course, an endangered species when you have these transnationalist operations and institutions going after it.
One of the most important bodies that formed along with the United Nations was UNESCO. And out of UNESCO, I mean, this would really be an entire program or at least a segment, but out of UNESCO, we do get to Common Core, this, which is something that is part of an internationalization of education that is designed to break down Western civilization differences among peoples and replace it again with these notions of one world, of one culture that can be governed by elites. So all of these things have very long roots, and we do not see these roots because so much of this history has been eradicated, has been lost to us, and people do not study these things any longer. So many listeners, I'm sure, are hearing for the first time, even if they're very well educated, that Alger Hiss had a lot to do with creating the United Nations, a Soviet agent. I mean, this
as I recall, he presided over the foundational meeting of it out in
yes,
San
he
Francisco.
Did. Yes, he did.
Dinah West, let me switch gears a little bit. We've been talking about Russia, of course, and the UN, but there is a sense among people surrounding Donald Trump, if not the president-elect himself, that there may be an opportunity, if I may use the word, for a reset with Russia. I'd be very interested in what your thoughts are on the advisability of that under the leadership of Vladimir Putin.
Yes, well, Putin presents a very interesting symbol to Americans at this point. As we've discussed, the left has suddenly discovered a Russian threat that is distracting us from all manner of other threats, including Islamization, including immigration, and so on, that continue apace. The right, however, seems to be having some kind of, I think, false sense of commonality with Vladimir Putin and sees him as a foil to President Obama, particularly in this latest, what seems to me a very trumped up matter of returning 35 Russian diplomats in this latest Spygate that we've been watching over the holidays. I hope that part of this is actually a very smart way of understanding that the United States military might and position in the world is severely compromised, having gone through the past 10 years or more than 10 years of war, and certainly the past 8 years of the Obama-Clinton administration, and that this is merely a period of in which to for us to regroup and replenish our forces, and not really a matter of outreach in the belief that America and Russia have very many things in common. There may be areas of commonality. There is no reason to be at war. There may be things we can accomplish together, and yet there should not be a sense at the back of our minds that this is because we are similar, or that the governments are similar, I should say.
Or that Vladimir Putin is a reliable partner for us.
This is something that is very important, and I hear that a lot on the right, that there is, you know, this crowing over Putin versus Obama at this point, I think is misplaced in the sense of enthusiasm.
And potentially quite problematic indeed. I think it's fair to say that there are some on the right who are beguiled by this, but there are many of us who I think feel as you do that this is ill-advised. Diana West, thank you very much for your time. It's always great to talk with you. I look forward to doing so each week in 2017 and appreciate your visiting with us today. Next up, we'll be speaking with Jim Hansen straight after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Our guest for this segment is my friend at the Center for Security Policy, our Executive Vice President, Jim Hansen, a former special operator in the United States Army, these days waging a war in a different form, the War of Ideas, as what I like to think of as a special forces member in the War of Ideas. Jim Hansen, you have been much in evidence in a variety of outlets in 2016. I know you will be doing so as well in 2017, including Fox News. I'm very pleased that you're able to join us here as well each week. Thanks so much. Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, same to you.
I'd like to start, Jim, hearkening back to your days as an old special operator, there are reports that some special forces of the United States are being dispatched to the Baltics in light of evidence that the Russians are heavying up on their side of that border. What do you make of what's going on? And what, more importantly, Jim, do you think it should tell us about the possibility that Donald Trump seems to feel exists that that we can do business with Vladimir Putin or perhaps even partner up with him in some aspects?
It's concerning to me that in the final days of a failed administration, Obama seems to be pulling the pins on grenades and throwing them into the most dangerous areas to stir things up. I mean, he did it with the UN resolution against Israel. He's done it by declaring, you know, absent what many people consider definitive proof, that the Russians hacked our election. So in response to that, and potentially in his normal mode of business, Putin's doing what Putin does. He's flexing his muscle. Russia wants to be an imperial power. They always have that aspiration. And so when challenged, you know, they are prone to making provocative gestures. And he's been moving some of his strategic forces around, potentially including nuclear forces, towards some of the former Soviet republics. And I think that's absolutely concerning. But the reports that I read and have been talking to folks about state that we're sending special operations troops there as a deterrent. And I don't think that's accurate. You know, we don't send troops like that over there to be a hair wire, a trigger, or a potential, you know, escalator. They're there to train with our allies. And, you know, the former Soviet republics are supposed to be allies now. So I think it's careful, you know, to word things correctly. But also, we should also be cognizant that this is a fairly significant provocation by Putin.
Well, I'm wondering whether it's something that was in the works before this scandal over the spies and what has been done by Obama in response to hacking came to light. Let me turn to another topic, Jim. You've, of course, been following very closely, as have all of us at the Center for Security Policy, this problem of the Muslim Brotherhood and its operations inside the United States, doing business through, among other things, front groups like the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Of course, we've recently published a book entitled CARE is Hamas, which describes how CARE came about, this organization, as a front for the Muslim Brotherhood's Palestinian franchise, Hamas, a designated terrorist organization. Now, Jim, one of the guys who has hung with the Muslim Brotherhood in general and specifically with the Council on American-Islamic Relations for a long time is Keith Ellison, a man who is running to be the next chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Van Jones, a hard leftist Obama guy, has claimed he's the future of the Democratic Party. What do you make of his prospects and what it would say about the Democratic Party if, in fact, he were to be elected?
I don't think that Ellison is the future of the Democratic Party. I think he is the current state of the Democratic Party. So I think he's the perfect frontman for an organization that has sold out to the hard left and, in many cases, makes common cause with our enemies. They include the Muslim Brotherhood. They include the Islamist groups that Ellison goes to speak at, that he takes money from, and, you know, who funded things like his trip to Mecca to make his Hajj as a Muslim. You know, that's a fine thing to do, but when the people who pay for it are a group that is absolutely antithetical to U.S. Values and the Constitution, I think we should be concerned.
Including what is self-described as the overt arm of the Muslim Brotherhood in North America, the Muslim American Society, as I understand it.
I think you're exactly right. You know, if that's the group that you're willing to take money from to go make your pilgrimage as a Muslim, I think we've got a problem. And we have a video called Revolution in America that shows a member of the Muslim American Society calling for revolution in America in front of a room full of representatives of this group at their conference. You know, she openly did this in Chicago. That's not something we should countenance, and that's not something that, you know, any decent person would want to be associated with. But Ellison is, and the Democrats seem to have less of a problem than anyone should with a guy like him being their representative, being their front man.
Yeah. Jim, let me ask you about one other thing. We have for some time now been confronted with people who insist that what we're dealing with in terms of these various attackers is a lone wolf phenomenon that is somehow disconnected from any ideology, specifically, of course, Sharia, the Islamic supremacist code. When you've learned that the German authorities were on to this fellow who drove a truck through a crowd in Berlin in the run-up to Christmas, were you surprised that he turned out to be a known wolf? And what does it tell us about this kind of phenomenon of willful blindness, not just in Europe, but here as well, that so much of this seems to be going on despite the fact that the authorities are actually knowledgeable about some of these perpetrators?
Yeah, well, I think the concept of willful blindness, which was Andy McCarthy's brilliant way to describe a resistance to the idea that the facts in front of your face are the facts in front of your face. The enemy says what they're doing. You know, these people claim that they are killing in the name of Allah. They are doing so to take down Western civilization. And they continue to do so. They continue to say the same things and do the same things. And again, the left in Germany, led by Angela Merkel, is emblematic of the problem. They refuse to even take them at their word. You know, the guy's saying, I'm killing for Allah. They're like, well, probably not. You know, I mean, Obama's done the same thing when he says that ISIS is not Islamic and other things like that. It's a sickness. And, you know, fortunately, one of the things Trump ran on was being the antidote to that sickness and being willing to look the enemy in the eye, to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, and to start taking the actions necessary to keep America and the rest of the world safe. The sooner that starts happening and the sooner we face the enemy, name them, face them, and take them down, the better it will be for not just Americans, but the rest of the world.
Jim Henson, do you anticipate, in light of all that you've just said, that we might well be looking at, by the Trump administration early on, a decision to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization?
Absolutely. I think they've got the will to do it. They have, you know, they have the facts in front of them. They understand the problem, and they have said they're going to do what's necessary to keep America safe. First thing is stop pretending that the folks who say out loud they are our enemy are not our enemy. So Obama's been doing that. He's been wrong. The world is in flames because of it. There are bodies strewn across the planet because of that failure. And I think rectifying that, designating the Brotherhood as a terrorist group and beginning to take them on directly is a brilliant first step. I think they will do it.
Yeah. And why that is of such importance, it seems to me, is if you really look at these so-called lone or actually known wolves, so many of them have indeed been able to draw sustenance from or other forms of support, or they've been able to hide among the infrastructure that has been established by the Brotherhood elsewhere and indeed here. And I'm hoping that if designation does come about, that these kinds of operations will come under close scrutiny inside this country as well. Thank you, Jim Hansen, so much for the work you do at the Center for Security Policy and for joining us each week. We'll look forward to doing a lot of it in 2017 and appreciate getting off to a good start with you today. Talk to you soon, my friend. Next up, Dr. Louise Fleischman joins us. We'll talk about Russia in our hemisphere and the jihadists as well. That and more straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Dr. Louise Fleischman. He is a senior advisor to the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project at the Center for Security Policy and the editor of its The Americas Report. He is also an adjunct professor of political science and sociology at Florida Atlantic University. His latest book is Latin America in the Post-Chavez Age: The Security Threat to the United States. Always welcome here, especially at the start of a new year. Luis, Happy New Year to you. Good to have you with us.
Happy New Year to you and to the entire Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you. Let me ask you about some musing that you have been doing. We've been talking about it throughout the program, Luis, about Russia. And in particular, as we try to assess how problematic Vladimir Putin's regime is and the opportunities for partnering with him in the new U.S. administration, for example. Talk a little bit about what Russia is up to in our own hemisphere, Luis, Cuba notably, but elsewhere as well.
Well, absolutely. Cuba is, in, as you well know, Russia is in a position at this point that they claim they aspire to be a big world power. And they see themselves in terms of foreign policy as the legacy, you know, as basically following or continuing the legacy of the Cold War or of the Soviet Union. Therefore, the Russians have understood already more than a decade ago that they have very good allies in the Western Hemisphere, particularly the countries of the Bolivarian Alliance, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua. Nicaragua Ortega has had a long relation with the Soviet Union. Putin also understood the value of these allies to strengthen the power of Russia. So Russia has been cooperating, of course, on civilian issues, financial issues, economic issues, but mostly a lot of military cooperation. Remember, Russia is an economy that does not produce much. Their strength has been, since the Cold War years, the military part. So Russia has been providing military equipment to Venezuela, in particular to Cuba, and much of these weapons actually went to the FARC through Chavez, through Hugo Chavez. They have been carrying out military exercises with Venezuela and in Latin America. And then the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, brushed it off. But the reality is that the Obama administration has shown tremendous tolerance to that presence, that Russian presence in the Western Hemisphere, when in fact, when you look at what Jeffrey Goldberg called the Obama Doctrine, Obama sees or views the Ukraine as a natural place of a natural sphere of influence of the Russians. And so therefore he said, let's leave him alone. You know, I mean, they have a right to claim that sphere of influence. But on the other hand, we never call them on their interference in Latin America.
Yeah, our sphere of influence. It's a very important point and has quite far-reaching strategic implications. It will be very important, I think, for the new Trump administration to revisit these policies and in particular, more generally, lift up the importance assigned to this hemisphere. I'm encouraged, as I'm sure you are, Louise Fleischman, by the appointment of John Kelly as the Department of Homeland Security Secretary, because as Southcom commander, he was very insistent on that need for reprioritization. And in part, that was because John Kelly saw, and I'm sure does today, evidence of what I talked about with Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch yesterday, Louise, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, namely the presence in our hemisphere, not just of the Russians and, for that matter, I guess the Chinese as well, but the Iranians and their proxies, including Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations. We've also been told that would include the Islamic State. Talk about that threat as you see it, not just to our interests in the region, but perhaps to our own people here at home.
Well, there is no question. First of all, as we reported it, and also the Southern Command reported it, which is part of the good work that the Southern Command is doing, thanks to John Kelly, among others, they reported the infiltration of Sunni Arabs through our southern borders, using basically all the system, cooperation with drug cartels, cooperation with the coyotes that actually help immigrants to cross the border. And according to that report, 10% of the people who cross the border illegally are Sunni Arabs. Now, when you talk about Sunni Arabs, what would be their interest in getting here? You say a job in McDonald's or a job in the farms of Florida? Definitely, there could be a tremendous terrorist potential. And remember, Latin America, which is our backyard, or is, you know, is the neighborhood where we live, is either you have countries such as Venezuela that are openly supporting terrorist organizations or terrorist groups, or Nicaragua, and then you have anarchical countries like Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, where basically are areas where people, criminals, can do whatever they want because the state doesn't have enough power to enforce the law. And very often they also buy workers of the states or members of the states, like mayors, like ministers, like judges. So it's a very vulnerable area, and I believe that the potential to attack the United States or to filter terrorists in the United States or the southern border is huge.
Yeah. Hey, listen, very quickly, speaking of another place where policy redirection is in order in our hemisphere, Cuba. Luis, I know you've spent a lot of time focusing on the Castro regime, what it has been doing to undermine our security interests, both elsewhere in the region and here at home as well, especially to the extent that it's now being, I think, clearly understood by people in the Cuban American community as well as others, that Raul Castro now is using our so-called wet foot, dry foot policy as a vehicle for insinuating large numbers of Cubans into our country under very different circumstances than that policy was originally, you know, intended to accommodate, namely people seeking freedom from repression. Talk a little bit about what's going on in Cuba today and what Donald Trump ought to be doing with respect to it.
Oh, absolutely. First of all, the fact that Cubans actually send people to infiltrate and to spy on the United States is nothing new. And that these kind of activities include not only espionage or acts of potential sabotage, but also even fraud, economic fraud. For instance, there were networks of people associated with the Cuban government that committed fraud on Medicare and Medicaid, and was pretty much systematic. This is what is called a sort of asymmetric warfare, because if you look at the policies of Fidel Castro, the drug deals, the drug trafficking, was a way to undermine also the fabric of American society. They saw it as a legitimate war against the United States. So this is and I think today it's a very dangerous situation. And I think today many people are actually asking to reconsider that law, including many Cuban Americans. Legislators here in the state of Florida that believe that policy needs to be changed, the dry foot, the wet foot.
We will be watching this closely, Luis. We have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your insights, for the work you do at the Americas Report, and also, of course, at the Hemispheric Security Project. We honor Constantine Mengus by having at the Center for Security Policy. Keep it all up, my friend. We'll look forward to talking with you often in 2017. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.